some getting thrown into the fire. So we've got Chris Park from Gen Z, Jason Lake from Complexity, Andy Din, come on up, guys. Annie Din from TSM, Ari Siegel from Immortals, Nicole LaPointe Patterson, fresh into Evil Geniuses, and Alan Bunny from Panda. Everybody, a round of applause. Since we're at the end of our time here, I'm just going to get right into it. I'm not even going to throw any softballs. I'm just going to get going. If you have questions, I think we're going to leave. Chris, are you here? Are we leaving some time for Q&A?
Yeah.
Yeah?
We got an hour and 15.
Okay. Can you hit me when we're at the hour mark? So I want to leave 15 minutes.
Yeah,
that's
okay?
Awesome. So, how many here in the room are familiar with the Tfue Faze lawsuit, Faze lawsuit, Faze, good lord? Yes? Okay. So, there are some people who aren't. So, here's the situation, essentially. So, Tfue is one of the best Fortnite streamers around. Faze is his team, was his team. And filed a lawsuit basically saying you're trying to take 80% of my marketing money and you're not treating me well and you're having me do skateboarding videos where I get hurt and there's all sorts of stuff going on. FaZe has a countersuit. They are not pleased and it's, you know, it seems like something that can potentially, in terms of team and player relations, turn the world on its head. So I'm just going to throw it out there for anybody to start. What is the conversation like with your teams internally about contract templates and how they need to evolve to protect yourselves and put the players in a position where they feel like they are appreciated by the organizations? Anyone?
Am I gonna die? Am I gonna fall on this grenade?
You know what? Like, I think Jason, you're probably gonna be my default on it.
I mean, it's definitely a really huge topic, and probably would justify, you know, a panel of its own. But going back in my 16 years in esports, there's always, and stepping aside, I'm not gonna talk specifically about that one necessarily, but there's always been controversies, and there's always been more sophisticated team owners looking to take advantage of team players. What we're seeing, obviously, as investment capital is coming into the space and the esports player as well as the esports organization has become more sophisticated, is an evolution of those contracts. There's definitely an argument on either side of the FaZe Tfue case, but I think more importantly, as the industry starts to scale, as the industry starts to become more sophisticated, we are making great leaps in the sophistication of our contract, the sophistication of player representation. It's pretty abnormal these days to look to sign a player that doesn't have an agent and or a lawyer, which is a great thing.
And it's changed a lot over the last several years. I mean, yeah. A few years ago, very, you know, seldom few of the league players had agents, and you guys were serving as the team as well as the agency.
Right, and a lot of people, I had this conversation with an esports lawyer yesterday, you know, what do you really think of the new agents and the new lawyers, and I love it, because I remember the years where I'm trying to explain some of these clauses to a young person, or maybe the young person's parents who might not understand contracts, and I'm like, you need to get a lawyer. Well, we can't afford a lawyer, so when you go to approach a more sophisticated player, he's got an attorney at the table or an agent at the table, that actually makes my job easier. Because let's just get down to brass tacks. Let's talk about the things that matter. Let's not argue about these clauses that are just template across the entire industry. So as it becomes more sophisticated, in my personal opinion, I like this transition. And I think that there's always going to be cases where he said, she said, and this clause and that clause, and did he, you know, get enough benefit and enough fame and enough followers to justify this clause, you know, that's for the courts to decide. But I think in general the industry's come light years, and I think both players and organizations benefit from it.
Andy, as somebody who played at the pro level, and, you know, if you don't know Andy's backstory, I mean, he was playing League when it was still in beta before it launched in 2009. So you have really watched the space grow and blossom to the point where, you know, agencies are getting involved and traditional talent representation agencies are now, you know, that's the world I come from. And people are coming up to me going, who are the good esports agents? We need to bring them in-house. But what's your perspective in terms of what a player's rights should be in 2019?
So I think, being a player myself 10 years ago and, playing for 5 years, I think that it's honestly the best time and place for practically any pro player then and now, primarily because if you look at the esports ecosystem, it's heavily investment field, right? Most teams are losing money, if not almost every single team, they're investing ahead of time so they can see future ROI. Player contracts are at our all-time high, they make a lot more money than what teams drive in sponsorship and revenue. So it's definitely great for the players. I think in TPU's situation, what happened was that he signed for a fair contract, but he didn't expect his explosive growth. Over the course of 6 months, from being probably one of the most unpopular players in the world to becoming the most popular player in the
world. And FaZe Clan was sure to point that out when they countered, too. I remember seeing a graphic of his meteoric rise on social, right?
Yeah, so, outside of all the noise, you have to focus on where he was at and where he ended up. The second thing is really, in that specific case, it comes down to the TAA and the 80-20 split. Realistically, right, if you look at most sports players, they assign their rights for a dollar value, whether it's in the NBA and NFL, right? Like, players get, all brands and rights below their ankles in basketball. Whereas Tiku, he signed away all those rights, and then he wanted to call them back after he entered an agreement. He just needs to understand his value, and had he expected explosive growth, he shouldn't have signed that contract. That's just where it is.
How do you guys feel about, you have the brand deals that the teams do, but say a player comes to you and says, this brand has approached me as an individual. How do you respond if they want to do a deal with them just for him or her?
I can actually talk to that. So we actually have players on our roster that are Red Bull athletes and Monster athletes. So we actually have conflicting...
There's no category exclusivity?
No, not for us.
That's
because we don't actually have a drink sponsor right now. We did that on purpose.
Uh-huh.
So our players could explore the opportunity, do activations. We've even done activations with some players in Power Energy. So, to us, when they come to us saying, hey, this brand is sort of hitting me up, we're like, awesome. Like, let's do something really cool with them. We actually help them with their activations without, really looking for a turn on our end because... the bigger they get, the better it is for us.
So you don't ask for any piece of that?
Depends. It depends on the player, depends on the deal. Sometimes, with the player rights, they have to negotiate with us to obtain the player rights. In other cases, not so much. It depends on what the contract the player has. But for the most part, we don't really see that as a significant return for us. We're more just happy that the player's getting the opportunity. And usually these sort of brand deals are pretty cool because they get more exposure and they get to grow from it. And we directly benefit from the growth of our players. The bigger our players are, the bigger we are. So I see no problem with letting them explore those things, and we actively encourage our players to do that.
I want to touch on player health and wellness while we're, on the player track. I just saw yesterday Gen G announced a deal with LA Fitness, and Chris, remind me again, what's the name of the app?
It's called Simple Habit. It's a meditation app.
Okay. And, brand spanking new headquarters in Playa. Did I see that you guys have sleep pods? Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't tried them firsthand, but they're not for me.
It sounds like a United flight, or like the international flights where it lays all the way out. But, you're a doctor, so I'm sure you're always thinking about it. Complexity is based in the star. We all know you've got a partnership, and Uncle Jerry is one of your majority owners, so you're right across the street from Dallas's, from the Cowboys complex. How has that aspect of being a player on a professional esports team changed? Like, what's the most revolutionary thing or new thing that you are doing right now that you think will truly help with a player's performance and the way they feel physically and mentally on a daily basis?
Can I actually take this one?
Sure.
Cover? From a new perspective. So
yeah.
I'm 3 months into the esports world, and when I came in, I used to work in private equity, part of the investment group that acquired Evil Geniuses 3 months ago, trickled into management. And when I came in, I brought a lot of practices from the outside world, like comprehensive health benefits, 401k with match, those types of things, which to me were table stakes. If we have athletes, we bring in PT that come twice a week, do ergonomic assessments, we bring in optometrists, we have therapists in-house, mental coaching in-house, and the players were shocked and surprised and pleased, and that was surprising to me, coming from other lenses where that was just, it needs to happen in the space. That these are athletes, they put strain on their body in unique and different ways, and it's helpful for organizations to support growth both in the org and post time with the org, as well as in org performance. So EG cares a lot about these types of aspects.
Chris, tell us a little bit more about the deal that you guys just did.
Sure. So I think, we were referring to it as a player wellness campaign, but I think probably what makes it a little different from what a lot of us do in a lot of other subject matter is that we don't really see there being an end point. I don't think there's ever going to be a point where, like, all right, we've solved player wellness, now let's come up with something else.
What are the biggest issues you're coming up against?
Yeah, so I think there's a combination of two. So one, and I think it's largely because even though, like, folks like Andy, Jason, everyone on the panel, we're building really state-of-the-art great facilities, I think the industry is itself in its infancy about what wellness actually means. Not just what does a player need to perform at a high level, but also what do players and fans overall need for having sustained health, sustained lifestyles that are really positive. And so there's a lot of stuff, I think, at this point that, at least from our perspective, is still very easy to accomplish. Just even in Korea, for instance, it was sort of earth-shattering when we started to institutionalize that we weren't going to have our players living where they work. And that, you know, in Seoul especially, that was a really big deal. Obviously, that's not a model that necessarily has to be the case for everybody. But that, in any other context of any other careers that these players could choose, would not be revolutionary. That would sort of be obvious.
I'm glad you brought that up, because team houses, I remember when I first started diving into the space several years ago, and I saw that, you know, there was sort of these big brother situations, the big brother house sort of situations going on, and I'm like, so wait, you're telling me they all live together, they eat together, they sleep in the same vicinity, and then they get up and they go into a different room, and they're going to eat in the kitchen, then they're going to go to a different room, all in the same area, and just, like, play for 13, 14 hours. And I'm like, oh, well, I guess it's good for team bonding. Are we getting away from that?
Yeah, this is something we're really passionate about. Yeah. Like I said, we spent over the last year really trying to build up the infrastructure and a program to kind of address that. I call it esports 3.0. Real basic, esports 1.0, pro gamers kind of lived in mom's basement and traveled to events. Esports 2.0 is a game house phenomena that's been around for quite a while and still sometimes is useful, but esports 3.0 is really an approach, like we said, the whole well-being of our players and creating an atmosphere and a lifestyle that's conducive to health and mental well-being and, you know, hopefully success, right? Our players live in luxury apartments about a mile from our facility. They get breakfast and lunch at the Dallas Cowboys training table alongside the Cowboys players. They have a free gym membership to Cowboys Fit right on the property.
Alongside the players? So, like,
yes.
Seriously, they're...
the exact same facility.
At the same time, they're having breakfast and hanging out with the guys on the couch?
Yes, ma'am.
That's pretty cool.
And they get free gym membership to take care of that health and fitness. We have a sports hospital across the street where they get all their physicals, and if there's any preventative medical care or reactive medical care that needs to take place. We also have a nap pod that is really popular. I never get to try it out. I feel it's like setting a bad example, but it looks really cool. We also have a room in our facility called the Mind Gym that is just to study the wellness and the whole, you know, the performance of our athletes with our performance coach and our sports psychologists. What can we continually be doing to come alongside our players to make sure they're healthy, to make sure they have a healthy outlook and a healthy lifestyle and, you know, for long careers, things like that. It's very important to us.
Yeah, I mean, here's the reality. So you're dealing with kids in their late teens, early 20s predominantly. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And that's a big part of the conversation in nutrition. You can put that out there, but they're going to eat what they're going to eat, and they're not always eating the complex. So, Ari, what have you seen on that front? How is Immortals, what's their approach to nutrition with the players? Because we understand that the way you fuel your body and how hydrated you are can impact your performance.
Sure.
So I think across some of these topics, there's a common thread we found anyway, which is that structure is really enormously helpful. And part of that is a screening mechanism, right? There's going to be some players, just like there's going to be some employees, that recoil at cultural aspects of one company and embrace cultural aspects of another. So ours is a company that's going to be a better fit for players who lean into a more structured environment. The reason why we think that's important, a lot of our investors come from the traditional sports world, I do too. When you're in a field, you know, as a performance athlete, where you need to be able to optimize and peak performance at a particular time, having structure helps you do that. Because you can practice what it means to lead up to peak. There's a reason why athletes in traditional sports nap at the same time every day, eat the same thing every day, and have a routine that gets them ready for game day. If I'm having a bad day and I want to delay a call or I do a terrible job, I can move things around. It's not the same if you play at 7 o'clock. As it relates to nutrition, it's really interesting because gaming is so global. So something that we found, we thought we were very innovative. We brought in the caterer who does formerly the LA Kings, the LA Clippers, the Washington Mystics, a bunch of other pro teams, and we were providing lunch and breakfast for our players. And we were doing kind of two proteins, two carbs, you know, one of those kind of things, fresh, cooked every day. But what we found was when you have players from Brazil and Korea and Canada and America and France, they don't eat the same things. And so in an effort to provide this healthy solution, what we were actually doing was solving for nobody. So we needed something that was a little bit more customized. So we entered into a partnership with an organization called Eat Club, where you can kind of go online and pick among 30 choices every single day. So you log in by 10, we allocate some dollar amount, you pick what you want, and it shows up at noon. And we're able to really work with our team management to optimize for whatever a particular player's nutritional goals are. So for example, some player could log in and only see keto meals. Another player could log in and only see gluten-free. Another person could log in and see only high protein. And so between our training staff, management, and the player, we're able to give that person what we describe as the illusion of complete choice, but really a customized solution that aligns with their nutritional needs and their cultural sensibilities.
Measured choice. You yeah. feed them what you want them, then they have their choices.
Chipotle is the illusion of choice, too.
Yeah, no, and it's a good choice. But, you know, Ari, you brought up an interesting point, and that's culture. Gaming is so international, and Jason, I feel like it was one of the articles that I read about you where you said, we have to figure out a way to get international players comfortable with moving here. Because a lot of them don't want to, and we're in the business of winning, and some of the best players aren't from this continent. What have the learnings that have been most meaningful for you as you continue to recruit the international ladders? What have been some of the secrets to success? Anyone? Bueller? Chris, you look like you want to talk.
Looks can be deceiving. For one thing, I think there's a lot of different ways to do it. So, for instance, if you think about the decision tree, the first question you have to think about is: Are you importing a team? Are you transplanting a team, or are you transplanting, let's say, individual players? You might be able to, for instance, like for our Overwatch team, right? So Seoul Dynasty is based in Korea. Next year we'll be starting our home matches there for the first time, but they've been playing out of Los Angeles for the last 2 years. And so there are cultural adjustments that have to get made there, but there you're bringing an entire group over that has the same culture, they're all speaking the same language, and we've been very intentional about keeping it that way. Other teams have done it differently, and we'll see sort of over time. I think there might be best practices that work out for one as opposed to the other, but to be explicit, there are certain risks we think with going with a United Nations team that we have been more challenging than have been worthwhile. And then I think, though, even for us, even when you bring, let's say, an entire Korean team over, what I found really interesting is when you have part of the great thing about our team facilities here is that our corporate staff tend to intermingle with the competitive folks, too. So seeing a lot of white corporate staff folks in our office, learn to live with the smell of Korean food coming out of a cafeteria. I think those are all really good things, by the way. I think it really challenges culture in a positive way, and it also means that we have to be very specific about how we select for staff that way, But so you know, there's multiple dimensions to that. So the upshot, I would say, I have a clear answer to that. I think, you know, frankly, it's not all that different, probably, from what is going on in traditional sports too. You know, Greg Popovich probably has 20 years of experience now, bringing together intentionally players from lots of different cultures, and he has a certain way, a certain probably expense budget as well when he takes them out to dinners. But it's, I would say, it's one of the more exciting things for all of us to work on.
How much do you find that language is one of the great barriers for players feeling comfortable here who are coming from overseas? I'm just going to start calling out people if you don't proactively talk.
A lot of the games for us are very international, and well, gaming is sort of the language they truly speak. You know, so when it comes down to it, they sit in front of a controller, they sit in front of a screen or a keyboard, and they know what to do. You know, so the cultural aspect, there is some things to overcome. There's some things, including giving them food that they know and love, or finding a nice cream barbecue place or something if you have your Korean player coming out to an event, you know, for them to feel more comfortable. That there is that element, at least from our experience, our international players, you know, they just get in the zone when they're ready to compete. And it doesn't matter where they are, it doesn't matter what, you know, country they're in, you know, they can just focus on that and hone in on that. It helps that, like, a lot of our staff speaks Japanese, and a lot of Japanese players, you know, we have a lot of fighting games, and they do a lot in Japan, you know, but frankly speaking, even the ones that don't speak Japanese are able to get the players over comfortable enough to just get in that zone.
Want to transition to investment. Just sort of being out in the space, I've had so many conversations over the last, I don't know, year or so, VCs and PEs that are interested in investing in esports. And they're always asking, do we invest with publishers? Do we invest in events? Do we invest with, pardon me, individual teams? Or to go even more micro, individual players? There are different investment models here on stage. I think Alan's philosophy is most different in that, and please correct me if I'm not getting this exactly right. You know, you guys really focus on 1v1 games. You are looking for more organic investments, less celebrities, less VCs, where there's, you know, a lot of VC money on this stage. And, you know, Immortals in particular, you've got so many high-profile investors, you know, whether it's like AEG or Lionsgate or Meg Whitman, the former head of HP. So I guess the macro-level question is, what's your philosophy when you're vetting? And what is your strategy for investment? I'm going to start with you.
All right, yeah. No,
you're kind of the outlier here.
We're pretty neutral. I think if you Google me, that there's an article about how we say no to VCs, actually, from the Esports Observer.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Send them our way.
you know, it comes down to the vetting process. And it wasn't the title of that article is a little misleading. We don't say no to VCs, but it was that a lot of early VCs that were coming into Esports were looking for that fast turnover. And just like Andy said, most teams are not making money. You know, we're in a fairly good place because we're very happy that our 1v1 niche, we've been able to really take it, you know, to the next level, knock it out of the park, and we're still struggling. So we're doing okay, but, you know, other people, they are trying to pitch this pie in the sky. Yeah, we can, you know, triple your money in 3 years, you know, sort of field in about a year or two ago. And to us, this was like, this is ridiculous. If you're going to do esports, you do esports long term. If you're going to invest, you're looking at 5, 10, 20 years down the line. You make something that's going to last. You don't make something to just turn around. So specifically the VCs that we had been talking to, we did not click with that sort of mentality, and we just did not like that philosophy they had. So we said, you know what? We're not in any rush. We don't need the money from them right now. So we just decided to wait and calm down. And I think that panned out because, I'm sorry, I'm not going to send VCs your way right now because I think they're starting to wise up. They're starting to see that esports is not a short-term thing. It is a long-term thing. There are some downsides to going in now, in the short term, but there will be that, you know, rainbow at the end, you know, of the rain.
What's the downside?
There's not many immediate returns. It's very difficult to monetize. Very difficult.
What's that? I mean, how do you determine ROI? Like, how are you having that conversation with investors?
How many hours do you have?
Okay, in 30 seconds or less.
I'll let someone else take that.
Ari, when you're having those conversations.
Well, I was kind of making a flippant joke about VCs. For us, a critical thing is trying to align our time horizon with the horizon of the investor. I think that's what Alan was kind of driving at. And to the extent that there's any investor that's expecting to triple their money in 2 years or something like that, probably not the right fit for us, because we're trying to invest in infrastructure that will yield like a scalable and ultimately sustainable return over a longer period of time. And we think that's like a 10-year journey, not a 2-year journey. And so
what you're doing is way more complicated too, because you've basically become a holding company. Mm-hmm. And you know, you just did this whole deal fairly recently with, was it Infinite, is that right? With Optic Gaming?
Yes, we did two deals in the last 12 months. One was to separate our esports business, our esports team operating business, from a software platform in Brazil, and the second was to acquire Infinite.
Yeah. So you got a lot going on over there. Jason, we were talking a little bit before we got started. So Jerry Jones and, John Goff, is that right? Big real estate mogul are your two majority investors. And you were very particular and you took your time in getting that deal done. It took probably, 2 years or so? And you talked about the timing and the number and how important that was. Can you sort of take us through how those conversations went and how they evolved and how you knew that it was time to pull the trigger?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, when you do these types of things, there's always the spreadsheets, there's always the black and white, but I'm much more of a relationships person. I believe long-term business success or failure can hinge heavily on the relationships at play. And if you do a merger of that type, it's sort of like a marriage. If you don't have the right partner, if you don't have the right vision, if you don't have the right goals and realistic expectations, if you don't have that transparency and honesty, I think you're going to have a pretty difficult time. And it took me some time to find the right group. Much like you were saying, there's a lot of different mentalities that were entering the space a couple of years ago. And towards early 2017, I first met the Jones and Goff group. And once we started sitting down and analyzing, like, what would it look like to put an esports organization, you know, at the headquarters of the world's most valuable sports franchise, how can we make 2 + 2 = 6 and try to scale both? And it's been one of the more interesting things I've ever taken on in my time in business and law, integrating an esports company across the Dallas Cowboys, from the legal to the social to the marketing to the sales, to everything that they're doing with their charitable endeavors. How can we contribute? And the thing I'm happy to say that has surprised most people is how much we actually contribute to them.
That's what I was just going to say, because, you know, at first glance, of course, the Cowboys can help you scale. How are you helping them scale?
Yeah, that's the obvious thing, right? Like, anytime you plug into an organization the size of the Dallas Cowboys, it's pretty apparent how that can benefit the esports organization. But I think a lot of groups from the NFL and other professional sports are trying to figure out how to live digitally. They're trying to figure out how to speak to this demographic. They're trying to figure out online streaming, trying to figure out how to maximize their sponsorships across an ever-changing media landscape. And that's kind of where we grew up. Esports was born and bred online. We were born in, you know, the streaming world. And we're pretty darn good at it. Of course, we're still learning. But a lot of things to them, they're like, oh, we need to sort this out. How we go to market, we're like, well, boom, boom, boom. So they're just like, and a lot of our processes that we didn't think were that sophisticated, when you're dealing with an infrastructure that's been in place for decades in traditional sports, and they look how we do it, they're like, wow, that is way more efficient than we're doing things. So it's been a very mutually beneficial relationship, and we're still learning a lot, and so are they. And it's been very important to me to make sure we are integrated. It's not just smoke and mirrors. You'll see this team come in and that team come in, but what are they really doing together? Are they really aligned? We just did a huge rebrand to make it even more apparent to the outside world how aligned we are, and I'm learning a lot every day, and it's a great adventure.
Andy, what does your ideal investor profile look like?
I think that so far my current investors have been extremely helpful and strategic, in the sense that TSM is more than an esports team. We're also a tech company. And, you know, having Jerry Yang and, you know, our various investors like BVP, they've really been strategic in helping us hire people and also give me advice in terms of how to scale. In terms of esports being a VC, a venture return ecosystem, I do think that it does exist. I think it just has to be with the right teams. And it's got to be an ecosystem that consolidates to the top. There are going to be very few winners. And the guys that do win, they're going to win big, right? In terms of growth, I do think that a team like TSM, we've grown, you know, 30% to 100% year over year. Highest revenue, only team that's profitable in this base.
Why? So if you were going to give your top three reasons why you are in the black, what are they?
We made the right bets at the right time. We invested in the tech early on. And on top of that, too, we provide a lot of value to our players, so we're able to build their brand, negotiate the right rates for them, provide value to them, and in return, leverage their brand to grow our brand. And we've been able to grow at scale for the last 10 years or so.
What is the philosophy? And Alan, I'm going to start with you here. When you're looking at investors about your organization's branching out beyond actual gameplay, so can you talk a little bit about Panda venturing into the hardware space, a little bit about the product and why you want to go down that road?
You know, for us, the team, similar to what Andy was saying here, we view ourselves as more of an organization than a team. You know, Panda Global is a service that we provide to our community, to not just our players, but to all the people who play the games that we compete in. And we like providing those services, those infrastructure to them. Like, we've been doing statistics, we've been doing rankings, we've been adding value back to our communities. And, you know, we saw the opportunity to make this piece of hardware that no one was doing. It's a carve-out, essentially. It's like no one would have any interest in making this piece of hardware except for someone that plays competitive Smash Brothers. And if you play with a GameCube controller, it's an old, antiquated 15-year-old controller, and for this nice little wireless device, there's no easy way of plugging in unless you have a stand, a converter, and then an adapter, and then it's this whole thing. And we said, well, wouldn't you want to just have a little thing where you can plug in the Switch and then plug the controller in, good to go? And we did a little market exploration. People were like, we really wish this was a thing, and we said, okay. So we found an engineer that was working on something actually very similar, and worked with him, launched Panda Global Hardware, and we sold $200,000 with the Kickstarter alone, and it's not even on sale yet. I think we have 5,000 units sold, and trust me, my DMs are being flooded with, like, hey, when am I getting it? So it's shipping out now, it's on sale at the end of the month, but we're really excited that we're able to provide the service that we know no one else is going to do. And this really helps us, you know, diversify our revenue streams. We're looking at, you know, not relying on certain revenue streams as heavily, and we're saying this is something else that just we can do. Nobody else can do, because this is a service that these people wanted, that, you know, you're not going to see the HyperX and the Astros and the Logitechs making these devices because it's too small for them. But for us, it's perfect.
Anybody else, from when you're thinking about your sort of the long view of your organizations, do you want to become a holding company like Immortals? Is that something that is appealing? Or when you're talking to investors, they're like, nope, this is what we want to focus on, and this is what we want to invest in. What are you learning so far, Nicole? I know you're sort of...
Of course. Definitely. So I think there's a function of both, like, what titles and potentially franchises you partner with, because a lot of the franchising models out there now force separation of brand or different identities. So having a holding company structure enables more malleability in navigating that legal entity that's required. So that's like one function of it. EG actually has a holding company structure, which we are poised for growth. It is a function of a bit of our investor vision. But similar to actually what Alan was talking about, we're working on not the hardware, but the software and data play to diversify revenue streams, and being structured and being able to be robust to where the market changes and market opportunities pop up. It just adds some flexibility that we personally lean towards, just because it enables quicker growth and us to take advantage of opportunities when they arise.
I'm glad you brought up data. There's no shortage of data out there. And we are constantly having the conversation about, yeah, we can get the data, we can acquire the data, we can bring in a company who's going to give us all this data. We are struggling to figure out what to do with it, to really sort of go through and find those really relevant pieces of actionable data. What's y'all's learning curve been on that front? I'm going to start with you because you're a data freak, Nicole. So, and you bring all sorts of experience to EG on that front.
Yeah, so we take a two-pronged approach with data, partially because I guess I'm a data freak and I came in with
a
different...
I say that in the most complimentary way.
Came with a little different lens. So I think there's a very practical application of data, which is relatively table stakes for teams now. Like, our sponsors care about certain metrics and KPIs and being able to directly deliver, here's the eyeballs, here's your reach, here's your ROI on product or placement or whatever it is helpful. And teams have to be poised to deliver, especially as they branch out into more non-endemic sponsors that are, I'm going to say, more of a business maturity, less familiar with the esports history and models there. On the flip side, too, for sports that compete on online platforms or like computer platforms, data analytics to drive decision-making on roster, player valuation, gaming performance is, I think, relatively underutilized. It's something that EG we're looking to ramp up significantly because it's relatively easy to do in-house. And the more bespoke you can get to your team's needs, your own team's focus on how to perform, the better it is. You know, there are a lot of platforms that exist out there that, you know, we would dabble into, but we use a third of their services or half of their services because it never really hit our own use cases. So EG actually just hired a CTO 2 days ago that came from out of the space, but actually is a Hearthstone streamer. And we're building out a whole data and ETL team just to be able to really directly deliver on the unique aspects of what we care about and the data that matters for us to make decisions.
Chris, we'll start with you. And I'd love to just go down the line. And as you guys have all explored data and the benefits to each of your organizations, what would you say has been the most valuable data set that you've come across to help you in your daily and long-term decision-making?
To date, it's probably, at least in the 8 to 9 months that I've been in the company, actually been internally developed data on the early stage of the pipeline of players. So when we've been looking at, especially in Asia, prospects coming up and having a combination of our coaches and some of our scouts now look just at performance. That's probably, I would say, to this point, been the highest impact stuff. Before we go down the line, the other point I think is the trick here is there's always a trade-off and there's an opportunity cost here and all these things. So one of the things we've been trying to think through with scaling, even like investment in data, is it's all coming from somewhere else. And so if there's another lever that you could push or pull to influence performance of the teams, at least from our perspectives, there's still close calls about what are the ones that are going to make the biggest difference in the near term.
Yeah, so on I would say data is probably our single biggest focus at TSM in terms of an organization, right? If you look at the way TSM monetizes, we own various different websites and resources that provide statistics for characters online around League of Legends and various other games. And I think that data is the center of focus of everything esports related, whether it is your decision to pick up a player or your decision around wellness and nutrition, right? If you think about, earlier we were talking about nutrition and wellness. Well, the truth is, if you talk to like pretty much any nutritionist, there is no scientific fact that if you eat better, you play better, right? So what you need to do is you need to create a system to measure nutrition and correlate that with performance. And so how you do that is, you need to first leverage data in gaming and track whether the players are performing better when they're eating better.
And what are you learning? What are you learning there? Like, what sort of significant findings when you're implementing that data regarding nutrition and performance have you been like, that's what we're looking for?
So what I'm talking about is what needs to happen, right? Whereas it is right now, for example, right? So for example, based off the APIs that are available from publishers, they only give you actually minute-by-minute data or very bare-bones statistics, and it's actually really difficult to correlate that data to wellness or improvement or performance, right? And so in order to actually get measurable data at the millisecond scale, you need to build technology to do that, which we're already doing. Now, it's not at the point where I can tell you whether if you eat a hamburger, you're playing better or not, but it'll get to the point where, hey, you perform better on Mondays and Wednesdays and Thursdays, but you suck on Wednesdays and Saturdays and Sundays. So what is performance? How do you improve your performance on that specific day, right? And so the reason why I'm touching on all these points is because I think that for esports specifically, I think that data is more important for esports than any traditional sport, right? It's really difficult to actually measure things in real life, whereas you can measure practically anything online.
I'm going to give you a pass on this, Nicole, because you're still getting settled in. So, all right.
Yeah, so Andy's point is a really good one, and I think that's one of the benefits of structure, is it allows you to A-B test. So if you have the same structure Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and a different structure Tuesday, Thursday, and performance is peaking on some days and not others, that gives you a really leading indicator to look at what are you doing when performance is being driven positively versus negatively, and then that creates a data set that you can use, not just to have a great data set, but drive decision making. One learning on our side, you know, paraphrasing, but I think Mark Twain once said, like, sorry this manuscript is so long, I didn't have time to make it shorter. There's so much data out there that, like, just having data for data's sake, like, who cares? You know, what are you trying to solve for? What is the curve of success, and how are you evaluating success? And then how are you going to take those things and implement change? Something that we used data for in 2018 that was very helpful for us was we did in-house an exhaustive analysis of team-generated content. Every team every piece of content distributed. And we sorted by length, we sorted by content type, so we came up with, I think it was something like 10 to 15 categories, a pretty rigorous analysis. And that the reason we did it was we wanted to be able to structure content that would be able to achieve a certain objective. So if you're trying to deepen engagement with existing fans, what is the type of content you should do, and how long should it be, and when should you distribute it, and on what platform? On the other hand, if you want to put out a kind of content that's going to attract new customers, new fans, people that aren't necessarily connected to your brand today, what are the components of that kind of content? And that gave us a lot of insights to Nicole's point, you know, being in franchise leagues and having the necessity to build multiple brands, it was really important for us to figure out and understand that at some deeper level, how you can leverage content for different purposes and be very intentional about that.
Well, talk a little bit more about that, sorry, before Jason, we move on to you, because you have evolved your content strategy philosophically. Was it the data that led to that?
It was the necessity of trying to reach and grow our community that led us to try to figure out who's doing it really well. By the way, Andy's doing it really well. And others are too. This was before Chris got to Gen G, so, you know. I'm just kidding. I think it was... That's the problem we were trying to solve, was we were going to embark on this mission and challenge of operating multiple brands. It was right as Overwatch League was getting spun up, and for the first time, teams were forced to create a brand for a property. And so as we were doing that, we were trying to develop our content strategy for our Overwatch League team and wanted to go into the market with a point of view about how will we pivot this based on market inputs, our market feedback. And so that is what led us to embark on the study, and it certainly has informed our point of view. Now, a critical, I think, piece is just because we have the data doesn't mean we make the right decision on the basis of that data. So I think in our MIBR brand, we've done a really good job of understanding the market, understanding the community, and then being able to kind of lean into the things that work and lean away from the things that don't work. Part of the reason for that is that Counter-Strike is a 20-year-old game with a really established community, and there's a lot of long-time learning to build from. Overwatch League we have not done as well. That's in part because it's a really new product. It's still a little bit of a commodity product. You know, each of these teams, though they have a different name and a different city, is kind of really similar. There haven't been like the breakout teams yet to really understand what is driving alpha outcome. And so that will need to evolve over time. And that, by the way, that's okay. It's okay that we've done really well in one place, less well in another, but even when you do less well, you can try to understand why you're doing less well and compare the two.
I think that's an interesting point, and Jason, forgive me if I'm knocking you off course here, but you know, I do want to talk about marketing, and I think the inherent challenge in marketing for esports teams is that, you know, unless you're, you know, the predominance of your titles are in the fighting space, so there's probably a commonality among your fan base. But, you know, if you're playing 5-6 different titles that are in different categories, you got a first-person shooter, a MOBA, a Battle Royale, they're different audiences. So, you know, as you continue to sort of tweak your model, what games are in your portfolio, how much is data a piece of that to help you understand what demand is or what the potential is?
Yeah, I think Andy hit the nail on the head. The question in esports isn't what can data and what can science be used for, it's more like what can't it be used for, from performance to you know, science around the medicine and data. We're doing computer-aided design studies on the perfect chair that's in an affordable price range, so you have the right amount of spinal alignment for the proper lung placement and breathing, and the least amount of torque on your shoulder, your wrist, and your elbow. And there's a lot of science and data that goes into that. And we're also doing a lot of data-driven things about our audience and who are our fans, who are our customers, who's our core demographic we want to target. And that's not always the same for each game. I think it's 71% of people in esports follow one esport. And you've got the crossover people who are like, oh, I like to follow these three games. But by far and away, if you're a League fan, you watch League. If you're a Counter-Strike fan, you watch Counter-Strike. So understanding that nuance and respecting the fact that each community is a little bit different, it has a different pulse, it has a different flavor, and a different smell, and approaching it respectfully to market most effectively is very important, and that is always going to help drive that. We're about to open the public part of our headquarters where our fans can come off the street, sit down, play games, a giant video wall, this huge LED ribbon like Times Square, and as part of like playing for free, you can enter a certain amount of information, you can join our line, and what game you follow, things like this, to start to gather local data. In addition, you know, to the partners and the companies that we hire to provide us more detailed global data, I think data and science is providing a really exciting time for esports. We're growing up, right? I think a lot of people in the world are trying to figure it out, but like Andy said, few spaces in the world can actually capitalize on it as exactly as we can in the esports space.
There's been so much fascinating data that we've gleaned in the traditional sports space regarding training, performance, injury prevention, stuff like that. From your medical perspective, since you're a doctor, what's been most fascinating to you about, you know, any sort of performance or medical-related data around gamers?
I think it really depends on what you're looking at. If you're looking at the physical aspects of it, different games with different controllers actually have different types of injuries, different types of repetitive motions. So, like, looking at ergonomic solutions is not a catch-all. You can't just choose one solution for everyone. You know, if you just predominantly do PC games, then absolutely getting a PC chair would help. But then you look at console games, and the posture is completely different. The way that they approach the game is completely different. So for us, luckily it's one of the few times that being a doctor overlaps with being a CEO. I can, like, work one-on-one with the players to help them with ergonomic problems, or when they have issues, they can call me. As if, hey, my finger hurts here, and then I analyze how is their hand position, I look at the muscle that they're using, and I basically explain to them, okay, this is what you need to do to warm up. But, like, that concept, I think industry-wide, that health is important, that they have bodies that can break down, that they can sustain injuries, that they are just like athletes. The perception of that is getting so much more, you know, permeant in our industry, and it's getting so much more attention in the industry. So it's been wonderful for me as a physician to see, like, other people actually paying attention, actually saying, this is something we need to tackle before it becomes a major problem, and I can keep my players in the game for even longer. I mean, we've had player who's in his mid-30s, and he's doing extremely well. You don't see them in esports, but in ours, you get to see that because of actually the ergonomic way that the fight sticks work. And, you know, I was able to say, okay, this is why he engages more muscles and less demand on certain muscles, and, you know, able to tell players, okay, you need to switch your control to this sort of setup or switch your control to this sort of setup. So while I don't do anything systemic, because I feel like everyone's a little bit different in how they approach their games, it's been nice that I've been able to work a little one-on-one with them for that.
I want to switch to sponsorship. I was watching, I forget what session it was, I've seen so many, but Paul Brewer, who's one of the top marketing guys at ESL, was talking about their relationship with Mercedes-Benz, and now it's a luxury auto brand, and I think it really caught the space off guard when they started diving in and showed some samples of the content that he had done. What surprised me, I mean, it does and it doesn't, but when you think about sponsorship in the traditional sports space, like, you have Coke, and they literally have seven different agencies, and they're all doing their thing, and they're creative agencies figuring out, like, what it all looks like. But what Paul said is, because esports is so new of a space to a lot of these brands, They actually lean on the teams for creative guidance. What's your experience been in this space? And Chris, maybe you can talk a little bit about the new relationship with Bumble and them sponsoring the all-women's Fortnite team.
Yeah, so this is actually, for me, one of the biggest learnings I've had this year. So I thought this was an area that I knew well because...
And it comes from MLB, right. Like Grand Global Marketing, so like you have it all down, right?
Yes, I thought, you know, you have some quasi-religious beliefs, I guess, that you develop over time. And one of which was I had a real strong bias against sponsored content because I've never I'm used to seeing dashboards where generally the stuff that performs well is organic or it's player-driven, let's say. And you know, if you look at the bottom, it was always the source of fights with sales teams, frankly, about who gets to actually own what you go to a potential client with. And this is the first space where I've seen that kind of flipped on its head, where, you know, for instance, we're only about, 5 weeks into our partnership with what we're thinking of as Team Bumble, which is our women's empowerment platform, partnering with Bumble, and starting with our Fortnite team, where we've seen incredible engagement. Now, it's not a self-congratulatory thing. Like, I do think some of it is that we've come up with great ideas, we have great content creators who are authentic, and we do have, I think, as Bonnie mentioned, more of a meaningful seat at the table with Bumble and with other folks we've been talking to. I think part of it, though, is even broader, which is, I think, frankly, the audience that we're all speaking to, demographically, culturally, is also different and receives sponsors in this area differently from, let's say, a 40 or 50 or 60-year-old person watching the NFL, some of which is because the latter person may actually have some biases also baked into their relationships with sponsors, what they're used to seeing, whereas even now, I don't know how long this window is going to stay open, but I think there is a real sense of gratitude on the part of esports fans or fans of gaming when they see sponsors coming in acknowledging this as something much more than a niche passion. I think that's something we can all lean into. It's a critical time now for the teams to be then responsible stewards of that trust and also to help guide sponsors as they get through this learning curve, which I think will be faster than some people realize. But I think that's a generally really positive story to tell, you know, not just about esports, but potentially about the future of paid marketing.
Sorry, I remember reading not too long ago that you guys had a really successful campaign with KitKat. I think that's right. Can you talk a little bit about how that relationship's evolved and why that partnership is working for you?
So, to build on Chris's point, you know, unaided recall is a really important metric for sponsors. And in other words, without saying what's the official candy of the LA Valiant, can people just identify that KitKat is associated with the LA Valiant? And esports teams perform somewhere between 2 and 3 times better than traditional sports teams on that metric.
Why?
I think it's the points that Chris was laying out. Number one, it's the way that the integration occurs. Number two, people tend to see it with gratitude as helping enable the competition. I come from the NHL, and the NHL often performs much better on those metrics than, say, the NBA, even though the NBA is significantly more popular. The reason is, we used to joke, it's like really hard to be an NHL fan versus an NFL fan. Like, does anyone, I bet everyone knows what CBS or Fox is, but does anyone know what NBC Sports Network is on their cable system? Like, nobody knows the answer
to that.
That's
what the guide's for.
Right?
Exactly. Guide on your remote and you can search.
So, but if you're an NHL fan, you really connect to the fact that you're part of this smaller community and take pride in that. And the same is true in esports to some degree. It's like, hey, this is our thing. We're a community. We're not fans. And so people that help and support that with content or access to players or whatever else, I think often that can be seen as a positive, of course, until it's not. In the case of KitKat was really interested in experimenting, and something that they thought was critically important through that experimentation was storytelling. And the rivalry of Overwatch League and the fact that you could have a team from New York and a team from Boston, and that someone from New York or someone from Boston could connect to that content without knowing anything about Overwatch was really interesting. As I like to joke, like, everyone knows New York-Boston matters more than New York-Houston, and everyone knows as long as Philadelphia is playing, root for the other team. It doesn't matter if it's widgets or horseshoes or football or Overwatch. Some of these narratives just exist. And so the opportunity to plug into a weekend and being seen as delivering that content at grand scale and have product on site that could enhance the experience of those there And of course, the shape of a Kit Kat can be similar to the shape of a Thunderstick, and you can imagine Thundersticks of different colors to help launch the Kit Kat Duos product. So it was very much about a product that was coming to market, a story that wanted to be told, an irreverence in kind of certain brands in the Hershey portfolio that really aligns with our audience, a willingness to try product that's sampled in esports events, a willingness to try in esports similarly is massively higher than traditional sports. And so that was why we were able to partner with Kit Kat. It was really an alignment of their brand, their objective, product coming to market, and the story that we were trying to tell along with them.
Jason, when you look at Through the Smoke, you're sort of behind the curtain content for your CSGO team. That sort of content is really impactful because people who are fans of gaming, to be able to pull back that curtain, and for as great as Twitch is, and then I do think that's one of the great differentiators between traditional and esports, the chat function on Twitch really takes the middleman out. But the inevitability is when you're doing that sort of deep dive content where you are, to a certain degree, exposing your athletes, there's a time commitment there. And there are instances where there's drama that's caught on camera that is then being shared, and ultimately it can, you know, unintentional consequences, but can create strife. But you know it's impactful content, and you know it's what the fan wants. So how do you, and how does the rest of the panel navigate that conversation and find that balance between giving the fan what they want, but also being mindful that your players are there to win championships, and wins and losses matter, and that's taking time away from their goal to do that?
Yeah, I've always been a really big believer in content. We did what was arguably the first esports documentary back in 2005 that followed one of our teams to an event and you know, behind closed doors in hotel rooms, and just kind of told that story. And I definitely am not an expert in content, but I believe in transparency. I believe if you want to elicit fan loyalty and empathy and get people emotionally invested in your story, you've got to be willing to be a little vulnerable, and you've got to be willing to show the real story, even if sometimes that story is a little embarrassing. Sometimes if that story is one of seasons of failure that you're not really wanting to amplify, right? It's like, wow, we stunk these last three events, and we need this episode out, but that's part of the deal, right? And then when you eventually get that trophy, I think it makes it that much sweeter. And I think that's something that's beautiful about esports. You don't have to be 6'3", 240 to be an esports star. You can come from anywhere in the world and have that aspiration. So if you can look at a team and they're willing to be transparent with you and be like, I really empathize with this person, like that's me. Like that's me on this team. I think it goes a long ways towards building that fan loyalty. I think esports has been ahead of the curve in many ways. I think we adopted the content and the transparent content path much earlier than traditional sports even did. You know, before the 30 for 30, before the hard knocks, you know, esports teams were kind of out there, putting ourselves out there. And I think it's always been a strong and valuable trait of our community.
We've got about 5 minutes left. Does anybody have questions in the audience? Okay, I just want to make sure that we have a couple. I'm going to leave a couple of minutes. I do want to touch on inclusion and diversity. It's been a common theme throughout in the last few days. Chris, we touched on what Team Bumble is going to be with the Fortnite team. Nicole, I'm sure it's something you're really passionate about. But here's my question. There's all sorts of great conversation going on right now about the need to rein in online toxicity, to encourage, you know, kids from every race, religion, ethnicity, to present that opportunity and encourage them to do it. The conversation's great. What are we doing to execute on it? From a team perspective, what are you doing to get that message out and to set the example?
Sure. So, well, what we're trying to do is really twofold, which is one in sort of the garden variety day-to-day operations that you probably don't see, and creating cultures that would score better on those fronts than others, and then the part that you do see is the creation of platforms or properties, whether it is Team Bumble or other work that I know great. Team orgs are doing to accelerate the process of inclusion and diversity. I think these are obviously what we deal with are in the sort of programming language, like instances of much bigger issues, right? So toxicity in esports is a part of a bigger issue about, let's say, content moderation across all social media or all digital media. So I do think the bar is, you know, we're all doing things to kind of raise the bar, but we should be continually challenged by it, right? And it shouldn't just come from our community, because in some cases it won't. I think even our, whether it's our fans or our partners, should all hold us accountable, and we should spend very little time, I think, probably patting ourselves on the back for the gestures that we do in a given calendar year to make this better, but we should continually be looking for ways to improve. But by the way, like, not just in, you know, sort of the vectors of diversity or inclusion that are by now tropes, like, say, gender equity, but also continuing to challenge ourselves by the other kinds of other ways of sort of slicing the pie or other ways of segmenting the community and really searching for the pockets that are underserved in ways that we can improve, because that is ultimately, I think, maybe the other side of the coin of getting to work in a sport that it has essentially 100% addressable audience around the globe, is that we're not a niche, and if we actually believe that, given what the numbers say, then we actually have a much broader responsibility than, let's say, even some of the other most popular traditional sports out there.
All right, can you talk a little, I'm sorry, go ahead. I saw you pick up the mic.
Well, it's speed, you know, the message of toxicity and battling that is something that we, and within Panda Global, like, actually care a lot about. And like I said, we view ourselves as a service to the community, not just to our own players. And I just want to say that I think it comes from the top down that we have to be the examples within the industry of positivity. Like, for example, we've done multiple different cancer races, as a whole team. I get the entire team do like a 24-hour plus stream, you know, back to back to back, different games, doesn't matter, and people just follow along the whole way. They do ridiculous things I tell them not to do, like eat raw eggs. After I told them not to do it, just because someone donated $1,000 to charity. And, you know, this is, and we're actually ramping up for another charity drive later this month because a fan of ours passed away from leukemia, and no one really knows his story, and I want to be able, and his actual desire was, hey, if you guys want to do anything for me, just, you know, help other kids fight cancer, and he died the next day. I decided I'm gonna make this a yearly thing in his honor. But, you know, to be that example, and that pillar within the community, that people actually look to us and say, look what PG is doing. You know, keep it PG is our hashtag, yes, we actually take that to heart, and that, you know, this can spread, and it should spread, because toxicity brings down the community. It brings down gaming as a whole. And I don't think you can battle that just by saying, stop doing those things. You can battle that by saying, look how much more awesome it is to not be toxic.
You guys activated Pride, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
What sort of initiatives are important to you guys in terms of inclusion and diversity?
I think Chris made the right point, which is this is too big and broad of an issue to be kind of put in any box or any multiple boxes. So we attack it both specifically and comprehensively. I think something about the Pride activation that I'm proud of is that, number one, it was part of a broader initiative. So the campaign was Be Valiant, and we took on a bunch of different opportunities to really empower or embrace or invite maybe underserved communities in gaming into our community. So there was a fan artist community reach out. There was a women in gaming event. This was one targeted towards the LGBTQ community. And that was one thing. The other thing that I was really proud of is that it was a 360-degree activation. It wasn't just one thing. We didn't just put out a piece of content with a rainbow on it. We didn't just like show up in the Pride Parade and march and be present. By the way, either of those things would have been great, potentially, but we tried to push the boundary a little further. So we actually had supported it. And not only did we activate at that bar on that day, so creating continuity and really, really an authentic connection between the location, the fans, and our brand, but we reinforced that with kind of on-jersey signage, so we were the first team in esports to wear a rainbow patch on jersey in competition, just like some of the NHL teams do around Pride. We partnered with the You Can Play Project. We think that message spans traditional sports, esports, and everything else. We did participate in the parade. We had streams that supported the effort, and so
we didn't just do the one thing of check the box, hey, look, we're doing this thing that's for a community. We really made it something that was thought out end-to-end and really activated around our existing fans, brought new fans in, welcomed fans of other teams, and had a community impact.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. We're pretty much at the end of our time, but I saw some raised hands, so can we take a couple of questions? Yes, sir. I don't know if there are mics out there, so hopefully you can project.
So talk about the profitability of teams. This League of Legends is kind of like global boost right now, and you talk more about Fortnite and the profitability of Smash. And then being able to look for a jungle flat pick, that's a lot of direction.
Well, League's been around, what, 10 years now? And has been able to survive the launches of the Overwatch Professional League and PUBG and Fortnite and all that sort of stuff. So when you look at sustainability, is League the model? Do we see Fortnite potentially being that? I'm probably a little too early to tell, but curious about your thoughts.
I'll speak to it since I'm not neither. It gives me an objective platform. In my personal opinion, Riot's League of Legends is the best franchise platform. For several reasons, we don't have time to go in. I'm definitely rooting for Activision and the properties they're building. I think they're really compelling. But if I could pick one, it would be League of Legends. I don't know that we can call it a golden goose necessarily, but I think it's got the highest chance of succeeding.
And I'll actually say for the fact that I don't do any of those games, even Fortnite, Panda Global, we're pretty happy in our genre. You mentioned Smash. The games we do have existed as esports before the words esports came around. By not falling, well, I don't want to say falling for, but by not doing games like Fortnite, yeah, we can miss out on really cool waves. And, you know, yeah, that means that we could miss out on some awesome activations, but we also missed out on H1Z1. We also missed out on those other games that may not have done that. So we're pretty immune to those like peaks and troughs of the gaming industry that can happen as esports is sort of starting to mature and starting to blossom, and we're watching the industry become more stable and view, just as you're saying, which franchises are working, which ones aren't working as well. You know, what do we want to do in the future? And in the meantime, we're going to sit cool because, look, you know, people still play Smash 64. That's ridiculous. And you know, so I got a couple players because cool. And you know what? That's not going to go away because it's been here for 20 years. And, you know, I think 20 years, people still didn't do it. So.
Anybody else? Yes.
Do you feel like we're getting too far away from the core goal of esports, which is fun? Do you feel like teams can become too corporate in a way that hinders tournament performance and fan engagement?
That's a good question. From my very limited experience in the space, I think there are a lot of benefits to professionalizing, and you use the word corporate, but, you know, like a good example, like the health and wellness, if there wasn't that transparency, that external pushback to make things better, to be more player-focused, player-first, the fans will feel that pushback, the community will feel that pushback because it's not sustainable, and it might not be ethical. Like we started with the Tfue phase question, like, there's... You know, of course, there's always risk at losing that authenticity of what, you know, sparks joy in the community. But without progress and growth and constructive criticism from an external force, the pendulum won't swing to a sustainable level.
I love you, Frank, and I love that you would ask a bunch of CEOs if we're too corporate. In all reality, I think as the industry scales, we're going to need the corporate folks, right? But I think as long as enough of those corporate folks really give a damn about gaming and competing and really truly love the games, we're going to be fine. Like, you look at guys like Andy, he's been around forever. Like, if he loses to Steve at Liquid, I guarantee he's pissed off. Like, it's not just a spreadsheet to him. He loves gaming.
I can see him going into a deep spiral
right now.
And
you look at the other people
in
the community, I still believe there's definitely enough people that care deeply about gaming and about the competition in gaming and go home and play games. I think we'll be just fine.
You okay, Andy?
I think overall, in terms of where the industry is headed, it's ultimately way better for the player. Given me being a player, I had to do my own dishes, I had to clean, I had to worry about various other things paying the bill, like paying for rent. Practically so many tasks that I would have to focus on otherwise versus competing, right? And because there are esports teams, we are able to invest into doing that for them. And so these players are naturally playing on a much higher level on stage now than they would be if they were to be focused on various other meaningless tasks that don't affect performance.
Okay. Quick question for Andy. How do you spend your time when it comes to building your brand, being effective, building your work, being your win, and developing products?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we operate similar to Ari as a holdings company. We've been a holdings company since we started, where we've acquired various different tech products throughout the years. We've probably made over 10 company acquisitions in the last 10 years. When it comes down to it, it's really about finding the right people. I used to do sales for our whole entire organization up until 2 years ago, and we brought Brad on. For esports, practically, right? Lena operates all of our esports talent. She does all the recruiting, signs all the contracts, and I'm here to set the vision. So ultimately, I'm finding people that are just really great at operating my vision, more or less. But in terms of like just thinking about the space, I think that there's a lot of synergy to what we're doing with our app and also with performance, right? I think that 5 or 6 years down the road, the app that you guys see today, we're helping people by providing them personalized stats on how they perform. 5 years from today, we're going to be telling them exactly what they need to do to improve. And we're going to be able to coach practically any gamer. And I think that our app's also going to be built in a way where we're going to be able to coach our pro players. Right now, we're tracking event by event. Let me give you guys an example, right? So, like, if you guys were to go to the gym and you guys were to shoot, like, 10 basket shots, our app essentially would be able to tell you how many shots you missed out of the 10. Say you made 7, how many did you miss? You missed 3. Out of those 3 shots you missed, within those 3 shots, how much power did you put into each shot? Was your form bad? Where was your leg? Where were you looking? Were you hungry? Were you tired? Et cetera, right? So I think that's basically where we're headed. But that ties into esports, that ties into performance. So everything we do, it's really about esports performance. And I'm just tackling it in a different angle rather than just recruiting players to join us.
Awesome. All right, one more question. Yes, sir.
So we hear the term talent pro a lot. Coming from the computer space, I'm wondering, as you know, a group of CEO, what do you guys think about the possibility of developing, the relationship between collegiate programs that are now starting up and getting bigger and bigger within North America, developing a more clear line in terms of, okay, how does this player
interesting. We've talked about this too, because when you look at traditional recruiting pipelines, the NFL recruits from college recruits from high school, and obviously so you guys predominantly lean on ladders and rankings. What is the potential there to develop further recruiting pipelines through college?
I just want to make a quick comment about collegiate esports, which may not be directly responsive to your question. Others can probably answer that better than me. And I think we're fortunate that in Southern California, there are a lot of really progressive leaders in schools that are creating programs, like Mark Deppy at UCI, who got robbed last night when Harrisburg won.
He feels that way, too. Yeah. I do. I'm a little biased.
Just, so something that I don't think we think about or talk about enough is that collegiate esports now is really what amateur athletics at the college level is supposed to be. It's about people coming together because they love to play. They learn to play on a team. They get the chance to compete. Sure, some of them might ultimately be pro, but to the extent that they have a career that touches esports or gaming, it probably won't be as a player, but it'll be through an experience they had or something that they were exposed to by virtue of their participation. And I just think it's a beautiful thing. I mean that totally genuinely and non-flippantly. And while there will always be a path to pro component in any slice of college or amateur athletics or any other field, by the way, there's pre-med, right? Like, where people talking about the path to pro and thinking about that as a box versus the rest of the collegiate experience, not in the same way. I just think what's happening in collegiate esports now has a potential to be a transformative experience for thousands and thousands of people around the world, bring people of different cultures and genders and ethnicities together. And so I'm very excited to the extent that Immortals can participate in that.
Path to pro through college viable? And if so, timeline to get there? Because, you know, scholarship programs at universities are only 6 years old at this point.
I personally think it's going to be extremely challenging. Like, if you look at the football clubs over in Europe, right, they recruit players at a really young age to bring them in-house. So I think in the long run, teams are going to build ecosystems below their pro team, whether it's academy or junior or youth. That's really how teams are going to develop. And, you know, there are going to be the stars that go through the college ecosystem and get recruited there. But even now, right, there is an online ladder. The ecosystem is digital. The great thing about gaming is its connectivity, where you can practically play with anyone around the world, right? I can play with someone in Africa. People are learning English by playing games. And because of that, it's going to be really challenging to purely just recruit through college when you can have, when you have access to pretty much everyone already.
And I'd also argue, what is a pro? Is it just being good at the game? Are you looking for just the best player? TFU, we mentioned him several times now. Is he a professional player? Is he the best player in Fortnite? No. But is he the best pro you'd want on your team? Probably. And I'd argue that line blurs a lot. And, you know, who is the most valuable is not always the most skilled. And that, you know, blurs the line even more. Age doesn't matter, performance matters, but how much does it matter? And it becomes this more holistic approach of there's so many aspects to recruitment that a single system has not nailed it yet. They all just sort of help us put someone on a radar and then say, do they have the other aspects we need?
Well, let me play devil's advocate there, because one of the things that we know about the pro circuit, I mean, so many of these kids play solo queue growing up, right? They've never been coached. They've never really played within the confines of a team structure. They've never had to like be in the same place and develop that chemistry and all that sort of stuff. That's something that you can do in college now. So to your point, when you define what is pro, if being a good teammate, if being a good leader, if being a good communicator, those are really valuable skill sets beyond the talent in and of itself. So, I mean, is what you're saying maybe an argument in the pro for taking a closer look at collegiate players?
I would argue, back to Andy's point, you can get on Discord and find a team and start communicating with them if you're actually serious about like scaling upwards. You know, may not be as easy or as streamlined as it is in traditional sports, but it exists digitally, and tons of players do that as it is now. You know, when they're in their teens, you know, before they're even applying to college.
Discord's been the game changer. Okay. We have had a phenomenal panel. Thank you so much all for joining us and for you guys carving out time.
That was awesome. And I hope you enjoyed this. For me, I learned a lot from this. And thank you.